Good morning. This is 10-year-old Dara Curley, who wrote a letter to Liverpool football manager Jurgen Klopp.
So you're a Liverpool fan, are you?
No.
You're not?
No, I'm Man United.
So why were you writing to Jurgen Klopp in Liverpool?
Well, we were practicing how to write letters in school, and then I decided everyone else was doing fan letters, and I decided to write a complaint because they were winning too many games and I wanted them to lose more.
Lose, he tells us. And this is what Jurgen Klopp replied.
Dear Dara, firstly I would like to thank you for writing to me. I know you did not send me good luck or anything like that, but it is always good to hear from a young football fan, no matter what. So I appreciate you getting in touch. Unfortunately, on this occasion, I cannot grant your request. Not through choice, anyway. As much as you want Liverpool to lose, it is my job to do everything that I can to help Liverpool to win, as there are millions of people around the world who want that to happen. So I really do not want to let them down. Luckily for you, we have lost games in the past and we will lose games in the future, because that is football. The problem is, when you're 10 years old, you think that things will always be as they are now. But if there's one thing I can tell you, 52 years old, is that this is most definitely isn't the case. Having read your letter, though, I can safely say that one thing will not change is your passion for football and for your club. Manchester United are lucky to have you. I hope that if we are lucky enough to win more games and maybe even lift some more trophies, you will not be too disappointed. Although our clubs are great rivals, we also share a great respect for one another. This, to me, is what football is all about. Take care and good luck, Jurgen Klopp.
Football and philosophy all wrapped up in a great fat dollop of cuteness. That was Dara Curley reading his letter from Jurgen Klopp, as heard on Thursday's Drive Time. Now, we do love a bit of weather in this country, and on Tuesday, Evelyn O'Rourke visited the headquarters of the Irish Meteorological Society in Glasnevin in Dublin, and she spoke to Noel Fitzpatrick, a meteorology, climate and glaciology researcher.
So I worked in Canada for about 5 years in the mountains of British Columbia. So they have a huge amount of glaciers there. Glaciers are on the retreat at the moment. So I spent a few years up there basically setting up weather stations on them.
What is it about this work that draws you?
I guess glaciers are so responsive to changes in our climate. So they're often called the canaries in the coal mine, because small little changes will cause them to change quite rapidly. And they have a very big role in society in general, irrigation, for drinking water. So they do have a big impact.
And what's your own background then? What did you study in college? And tell me a little around that.
Sure. So I studied science in NUI Galway, and then I did a master's in meteorology. And then when I was over in Canada, the work I was doing there was part of a PhD.
What led that interest?
It was probably unusual. It started almost as a photography thing. I used to love looking at the clouds and at the sky. From quite early on, I was interested in weather, and I was talking to someone recently who said it was amazing that I've actually ended up working for Medair, and when that was something that I always said as a kid that I was hoping to do.
Evelyn also spoke to fellow meteorologist Sinead Duffy, and she concentrates on flood forecasting and radars. And she's talking Evelyn through the various forecasting screens.
So we've got some airport observations because we're sitting at the aviation desk. We've got a bank of screens, and we've also got radar sequence. So we can see data from our radar at Dublin Airport, at Shannon Airport, and on the website here we can see a picture with the four radar screens. Radar is actually really good for, say you want to go out for a walk, you can look at the radar picture on our website.
And that'll give you even more information.
Yeah, so sometimes we've got a front coming in and that can be a whole band of rain. You can kind of interpret,
walk fast.
Yeah, exactly. You can see if you'll be wet or dry for the most part.
And what is it about this work that you find so interesting?
Well, my background is I did my undergraduate in physics and maths, and then I did a master's in meteorology.
Like, were you just always fascinated by it? Did it come from home?
I love clouds, which is a very kind of like glib answer, but you know.
Just lying back looking up.
Looking up, you can see the sky changes, so very fascinating.
That's lovely though.
Yeah, it's a painting in the sky every day.
What a beautiful way to think of clouds. That was Sinead Duffy. And storms, Desmond, Dennis, Kira, just how do they get their names? Here's Evelyn Cusack.
Hurricanes were always named by the sailors going back hundreds of years. In our neck of the woods, we've really only started storm naming since 2015. And in fact, we have your own colleague, Theresa Mannion, to thank for making Storm Desmond very famous. Don't make unnecessary journeys. So, I mean, I thought I was pretty famous before she came along and she's totally stole my thunder. But anyway, back to the serious matter of storm naming. Met Air and the UK Met Office and the Dutch Met Office, we have combined forces, and from Met Air's point of view, we can say severe damaging winds from Storm Evelyn or whatever. We actually put out the call for storm naming suggestions during the summer, and we actually got 3,000 entries. Yeah. Whether you want your child's name associated with a violent, destructive force that can cause damage is another thing. But so I myself am the chairperson of the European Storm
Naming. And have we had a Storm Evelyn yet? She half nervously.
No, I haven't. No, I couldn't.
Or could you? Evelyn's Cusack and O'Rourke has heard on the Sean O'Rourke Show. And concerns about climate change were in the news with a landmark report from UNICEF and the WHO, which ranks Ireland in the bottom 30 countries worldwide when it comes to delivering on emissions targets. And this is putting children's lives at risk. On Morning Ireland, Brian Dobson spoke to Anthony Costello, Professor of Global Health and Sustainability at the Office of the Vice Provost, University College London.
I suppose no surprise that we're in the bottom when it comes to dealing with CO2 emissions, but we're also in the company there of quite a number of other relatively wealthy countries around the world.
Yes, well, you could argue that it's never been a better time for children in Ireland. And, you know, we're saying that there are immediate threats, mainly from the environmental and climate change threats, but also from exploitative marketing practices. But if we constructed a global index of 180 countries, and first we looked at children flourishing, and in fact Ireland are right up there at the top. They're number five in the league table when you measure it according to survival, nutrition, education, protection from violence, sanitation, and the like. So that's very good. Mm-hmm. But we're saying, look, we're at 1 degree of warming. The world signed up in 2015 to keep below 1.5 degrees, and we're going to go above that within 10 years. And we're expanding our emissions. And when you look at Ireland's emissions, for example, and indeed you could look at all of the European and wealthy countries of the world, you come 154th in the table. You're 208% above the 2030 target. And we can't ignore that. Look, we're seeing around the world on your news every day, heat waves, extreme weather, bushfires. UK is very flooded right now, droughts, people migration. 90% of children around the world breathe unsafe air. If we could clean that up and get rid of carbon pollution, then we would have clean air, clean water, a better future. But it's going to get worse, and it's irreversible, these changes.
And it wasn't just climate. Professor Costello highlighted other factors, including rampant advertising and online activity.
I think the biggest worry is social media advertising. You know, our children are on their smartphones 2 to 3 hours a day. Even as young as 5 or 6, they're playing games. And those games are harvesting their information, giving them to advertising agencies, selling them to Facebook and Google, who then target them with new ads. And this whole process is completely unregulated.
Anthony Costello, we're just up against the clock. We'll have to leave it there. It's a very interesting report, and you also have recommendations as well. We don't have time to go into them, but one of them I'll draw to our listeners' attention, and it's to incorporate children's voices into policy decisions. A good place perhaps to start.
Well, with those words ringing in our ear, let's tune in over here.
Chucky P.
We can make a difference in our own small way.
It's one small change, we can do that today.
Our mind's getting bigger while the world's getting smaller.
But saving the earth's becoming a tall order.
From the minute you awake from your nightly nap,
you can make little changes like turning off the tap
while brushing your teeth in the bathroom.
You can cycle or walk your way to the classroom.
These are the children from Campabwee National School, a tiny two-teacher school in rural County Cork, which has 23 pupils ranging from 5 to 12 years of age. They were so appalled by what they found on the strand while participating in a clean-up of local beaches that they turned the marine waste into an art project and were spurred into writing a song and making a video about it. This they did with the help of a local music producer and a former student doing the filming, all overseen by their teachers. And the rest, as they say, is history. Teacher Norma Healy and her talented, environmentally friendly pupils take up the story.
By doing small changes, we can make one big one.
My line is ice caps melting, seas getting high.
Recycle the plastic, bleach is free.
The world is a clock and 12 o'clock is climate change.
The koala bears are dying from the dangerous fires in Australia.
If we don't do something quick, the animals will die.
If they die, they will never come back.
Time is ticking. We better do something before the Earth is destroyed.
Put down the fuel you used to get to school.
Pile in! Let's cackle!
In your lunchbox! Cut down the plastic!
See? These things aren't too drastic.
Spread the word, get vocal.
Make it go global. When buying food, stay local.
Never mind the dishwasher, do it by hand.
But I hate washing up!
Ah, come on, it's grand!
Just one small change.
Pupils from Kappa Bui National School has heard on Mooney Goes Wild. And in East Africa, countries are experiencing drought, intense rainfall at unusual times, fierce storms and now, plagues of locusts.
Charity appeals and news headlines sound biblical, emphasising that billions of desert locusts are crossing countries including Ethiopia, Eritrea, Uganda, Tanzania and Sudan at a speed of up to 93 miles a day. Plague of locusts ravages countries as region prepares for another year of hunger, read one press release from Save the Children. In January, a locust swarm forced an Ethiopian Airlines passenger plane off route. On February 2nd, Somalia declared the locusts a national emergency, with the government saying they are a major threat to Somalia's fragile food security situation. Each locust can eat its own weight in food daily, meaning they pose a significant threat to crops and livelihoods.
That's the voice of Sally Hayden in Kenya for Sunday's World Report. And this locust plague is a direct result of climate change.
It's like being in a house that's on fire, but you don't even know it's on fire, activist Vanessa Nakata told me. Western emissions lead to African suffering, she says. Meanwhile, obviously keen to suggest solutions, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization has listed locust recipes on its website, confirming the insects are rich in protein and can be collected in large nets. Locusts are usually stir-fried, roasted or boiled and eaten immediately, or dried and eaten later.
Ooh, not sure about that. That was Sally Hayden from Kenya, as heard on World Report on Sunday. Now this summer, Ireland will host the Mixed Ability Rugby World Cup, which is now in its third year. And on Wednesday, rugby player James Healy joined Ryan Tuberty in studio.
Yeah. James, let's talk to you. How did you get involved in all of this, please?
Alan came to myself and my buddy Danny. He's taller than me.
So, Paul O'Connell and Stringer.
That's what you guys are like, hanging out together. Yeah. And when the suggestion was made, do you fancy playing rugby, James? How did you feel about that?
I thought, because I was scared first, so I said to Alan, would he say it to my mum and dad first? Because when I was small, I had kind of an accident. I fell out at home, I fell out the top window.
How old were you?
I was 3 years of age. Oh, and I was on the life support machine for 21 days, and the doctors and the nurses wanted to knock the life support machine, but my mother or father and family wouldn't leave him because they knew I was going to live, and I was born to play rugby.
You were meant to be hanging around here. I think that's the truth out of that story. And the rugby part of it then, when Alan approached your parents and said, can James play with us? Were you nervous of their answer?
Yeah, I was nervous.
What were you worried about?
I was afraid of them in case they say no.
Well, luckily they said yes and James made the team, and his day job is helping with training.
What do you do when you're not playing rugby? What's your week like? What do you get up to?
I hang out with my family and friends and that.
Sure, and do you do a bit of work as well?
Yeah, I'm working out in Vicar's Road in Co-op there in QDS.
Yeah.
And another part-time then I'm over across the road in the garage in Circle K.
And if I was to pull into Murphy's carriage in my car, what would you be able to do for me?
I'd probably put in petrol for you, or else I might give your car a wash.
Okay, I'll see you soon.
No, his partner in crime, Danny, is over there too.
So. Is this the Paul O'Connell?
Yeah, he'll wash the roof and James will wash the wheels.
So you got Paul O'Connell washing the roof and James. Peter Stringer washing the wheels.
Yeah.
So he's still like upstairs, downstairs.
Yeah. The doors will just be a bit stripey, that's all. Like, you don't mind that.
Are you good at it?
Yeah.
You are good. Yeah. Okay, I like to hear that.
Oh, sure, it's all good training. That was James Healy and Alan Crockwell ahead of the Mixed Ability Rugby World Cup. Rolling Wave on Sunday, Aoife McCormack spoke to harpist Leisha Kelly. She's getting Ciolthór na Bliain a Musician of the Year at this year's Gradham Ciol on TG Cahir, and she believes that her instrument, the harp, is making a comeback, if only it could get off the tax envelopes.
It's not as organic as the diddly eye of the normal mainstream stuff will say, because we're half looking back to our glory days of all the Middle Ages, right back to pre-Christianity. The harp was so strong, it was the thing, it's the symbol of the country for good reason. We loved it. And then you have Gerald of Wales in the 11th century saying we were the best players in Europe when the harp was widespread, you know. And it's the symbol since 1270. And that symbol was given to Ireland from people looking on the outside looking in at us. You know, so we were really musical and loved our instrument and we're very proud of it. And I think it's only really beginning. It's only beginning to come back now. Like, it helps with things like the UNESCO recognition this year, just before Christmas. And even with this Gradham Ciol, it's great recognition for the harp. It's like, finally, it's getting a little step up. Whereas it's every day in everyone's faces, on the money and everything, and yes, the tax bill. But it's not everywhere. The music is silenced. It feels very depressed, compressed, kind of.
But the thing about the harp, I mean, I know you were joking about the harp on the envelopes, the tax envelopes, but it is that thing of, it is in your face the whole time, though, which is a good thing, isn't it? I mean,
Well, no, I think that, genuinely, joking aside, I think the tax envelope is absolutely negative.
It's got a negative connotation.
Absolutely,
I think.
Yeah. Because that four-letter word, really, there's very few people that looks on the envelope, come in the door and says something, oh, fantastic, delighted to see that harp come in the door.
Leisha Kelly playing Brendan Ring's Jigs on the Rolling Wave. Back in a bit. Welcome back. How we interact with each other online was a thread running through much of the radio this week, prompted by the death by suicide of TV presenter Caroline Flack at the weekend. The anger and vitriol that can be posted, usually anonymously, on social media sites can be extremely hurtful and can have devastating consequences. On Monday, Ryan Tuberty spoke about his view of social media and Twitter in particular, a platform he no longer uses.
It's not about the papers anymore. This 24/7 following you home, this bullying, or just pure nasty, not even bullying, it's just nastiness, will follow you home. And that's what she would have been doing, reading those things. That's why I left Twitter. I mean, not to bring it back to me, but just very briefly. And one of the reasons I left it for several different reasons, but one of them was because people just were unthinking in their nastiness. And you don't need to be, I didn't need Twitter in my life, so that's why I left it. And it's the most liberating and important thing to do, because people will say things that, quite simply, I don't believe they'd say to your face if they met you. And that's what happened in people's lives. Sometimes they forget that, in Caroline Flack's case, that you have a person, not a TV celebrity, not a dancer, not a presenter. You have a human being who, it might surprise people, but they have feelings and they have a life to get on with. And you might think it's all glam for her, but clearly she gets hurt and people can be hurtful.
Ryan then spoke to Caroline's former stylist and friend, Fiona Fagan.
when we were doing the live final of Love Island, when I was styling for her for it, like, her mom rang her before and said, good luck with the show, darling. And she was like, no, promise me you won't go on Twitter after the show. Promise me. Because Caroline would go on Twitter after one of the shows and she'd get slammed and she'd be devastated. And she went, no, I won't. And then, of course, the show ends, the live final, and she goes on Twitter and she gets slammed for the dress she was wearing just because people want to be nasty. And then she was downcast for the next hour.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what
And the
mean.
Next day.
Yeah.
And so that's what you were saying. It's like, you know, you do go on Twitter, you know, you go on and you see all these nasty things and it's like just, you know, and her mum was trying to protect her, saying, don't go on. She's like, no, I won't. I promise me, because she knows she does it and then she gets so obsessed.
And on Wednesday, Ray D'Arcy also commented on the death of Caroline Flack and her use of social media.
And I've been reading a lot of the commentary about it and there's a little bit of hypocrisy out there. I suppose everybody's trying to do the right thing. And you would like to think, you would like to hope that Caroline Flack's legacy is that things will change. But I don't know. People pay attention to these things for a couple of weeks, maybe a month, and then it's back to the same old, same old. And, like, I don't want to say, but it is the scourge of social media. It's a scourge. Step away from it. Step away from it. It's toxic. And I know people claim to me, oh, it embellishes my life. I get my news feed on Twitter. But for the main, social media has had a negative effect on the world. And it's, I know the genie's out of the bottle and there's no way we can put it back in. But we need to be real about it and we need to be honest about it. And saying, you know, a few platitudes after some poor woman took her own life isn't enough. It needs to be bigger than that.
Ray D'Arcy on Wednesday. And of course, online abuse extends to all people in public life, not least politicians. On Sunday with Miriam, four women talked about the experience of having lost their seats as TDs. Here's Fine Gael's Regina Doherty talking about her experience in the Dáil and online abuse.
Is it more difficult, do you think, being a female politician than a male politician?
I actually don't know because I've never been a male politician. So. I tell you what I do know. I think we get more grief. I think we get more stick. Mm. You definitely get more abuse. Now, lads get loads of abuse too, but I think our abuse is very personal. I was talking to the ladies outside that if I had a euro for every time I've been called the C word in the last month, I wouldn't need to retire.
Which is
it
just
is abuse.
Shocking, actually.
Yeah, and like, actually, even what Jana's just pointed out, I've been witness to a number of emails, and I don't know whether you guys have got the same, from people who would have been pro-life gleefully telling me that that's the reason that I lost my seat. No, I don't. It's not. There's buckets of reasons why I lost my seat, and we won't pinpoint any one of them. But for somebody to be so base as to actually put pen to paper in an email and send you like their willful gleeness because of a particular issue, like, I don't know what the world is coming to be honest with you.
And online abuse was a cross-party affair. Here's Fianna Fáil's Lisa Chambers.
Yeah, Lisa, did you find that you got, you know, abuse as well online?
Oh God, yes. It was quite intensive, and I would agree. I mean, I think, you know, all politicians get abuse, but I do think there's a different level for female politicians. It's a lot more personalised. It's a lot more based on, you know, the tone of your voice, the colour of your hair, how you dress. I'm pregnant currently, so that was coming up a little bit as well, that, oh, she'd be taking maternity leave, no point in electing her. So there's an extra level, I think. You know, you just have to be so careful about how you come across, because being assertive, you know, for a woman is often being bossy or aggressive or whiny, or, you know, I think there's just a different standard, I think.
Fianna Fáil's Lisa Chambers as heard on Sunday with Miriam. And on Tuesday, Fine Gael's Frank Feehan spoke to Mary Wilson on Drive Time about the online abuse he had endured and the lack of support.
Nobody seems to be able to stand up for politicians, or if they're going through a difficult time, but any other profession, whoever is instigating the nonsense effectively of abuse, they would be taken to task. But sometimes it seems to be open season for politicians. And, you know, we have family, we are normal people who happen to be in public life and public service. We don't get it right all the time, But sometimes, you know, I saw in 2012 my good friend and colleague Shane McEntee took his life, and that really impacted on a lot of people, and it stopped for a few months. But then again, it was open season on politicians, and people put them up for public
and
life.
And Frank Fian, what is it like now? I know you talk of these two worlds. You say a social media world, a Facebook world, and a real world.
Yeah, look, it was great to see. I went out canvassing in Sligo, Leitrim, North Roscommon and South Donegal. You went to many doors. People were angry. People articulated their concerns, but articulated in a measured way. And you really respected that. And then you had the Facebook angle, especially. And there are two different worlds. And it is gratifying to see that, you know, there is that welcome anymore. It's there. It's still there on the doorstep, certainly in the Northwest, and I'm sure across the country. But sometimes we maybe pay too much attention to the social media and to the keyboard. I won't call them keyboard warriors. I call them keyboard cowards, because that's effectively what they are.
Fine Gael's Frank Fian has heard on Drive Time. On Wednesday's Liveline, prompted by the death of Caroline Flack, Father Ray Kelly talked to Joe about abuse he had suffered because of his role in Dancing with the Stars.
You know, I got the odd Christmas card from loads of people wishing me well and all that, but yeah. There was one particular card came anonymously, not signed, just reminded me that of what happened to John the Baptist when a woman danced for him. Some people, after I said to them afterwards, God, like, that's a death threat, you know.
Because John the Baptist was beheaded and his head on a platter.
I never actually saw it as a death threat at all. And I still don't see it as a death threat. I don't think, but, you know, some people say, you know, you should have reported it. I never actually reported that to police or anything like that. But, I had a few other negative comments here and there. I shouldn't be doing this. I know there was one or two said I shouldn't have been on the Late Late Show between two lovely ladies either, and, you know, and stuff like that. And, you know, like, as a priest for 31 years, I've never really experienced that level of criticism. I've always worked hard in parish and been there for my parishioners, no matter what parish I've been in. And, I mean, this level of kind of criticism was I've never experienced. Now, as I said, it's only about a half a dozen letters and cards and everything. And I think it came to a head there at the end of January when I actually took a phone call from a man, and I kind of was suspicious about his accent, and he asked for to speak to Father Ray Kelly, and I said, oh, he's not here, can I take a message, you know, and he said, well, you tell him from me, and it was a Cork or Kerry accent, that he's nothing but and every second word was the F word, parish, priest, old castle, parochial house, housekeeper, fat effing belly dancing around the floor. He should be effing ashamed of himself.
Oh,
and that really got me down a bit. I said, jeez, you know, I shouldn't be in this show at all. You know, maybe I should pull out.
Father Ray Kelly with Joe. And then Kevin rang in. He was against Father Ray dancing to glorify himself and for fun. And this sparked quite the theological argument.
Father, I'd like to say to you, though, that you cannot presume in any way that Jesus Christ danced at the wedding feast of Cana. He changed the water into wine.
It's a good start now for a dance, changing the water into wine. We're only going in one direction after that.
That's to the dance floor.
Kevin, you can't presume that he didn't.
I know you're making a laugh at me, but anyway, go ahead. Go on.
No, okay, I didn't.
Ray, go on.
You said you presumed that, okay, Jesus changed water into wine, but he didn't dance. I said, you can't presume whether he danced or didn't dance. I don't know either, but he may have.
No, 100%, like he didn't partake in that. What he was there to do, which was to give the people this thing that, as far as you brought up the wedding feast of Cana, was that they ran out of wine, and this was his first miracle, and he done that.
Exactly.
He didn't say anything about him dancing or anything else, and you can't presume that he done that. Father Ray, just to satisfy yourself, it's why you're bringing this in. Oh, of course he may have done. He didn't.
Well, who saw that coming? Dancing on the head of a pin, perhaps. That was Liveline on Wednesday. Let's change gear ever so slightly. The lyric feature with Regan Hutchins continued its exploration of different times of our day, and this week it was the turn of noon, and Regan joined writer Jan Carson for a stroll in Paris. How's that for swanky?
No, I think it's hilarious in Paris how many people actually wear red berets. And, like, lots of them should have better sense.
What does the red beret mean?
You know, like I've actually seen people at the Eiffel Tower in a black and white stripy jumper with a red beret. Like, I don't know whether they think they look authentically French or... They just like, they got like tourist written all over them. Afternoons are when I walk out ideas. I do think there's something about physical movement and the creative process for a writer. Even the sound of your footsteps. We're in the Jardin du Luxembourg that has that sort of strange, gravelly kind of sand everywhere you get in Parisian parks. There's a sound to how you walk here. It's different from when you walk in a forest or a beach. If I was at home, I'd be pointing the Straits of East Belfast at a big anorak. In Paris, it's a little bit more inspiring to get out and walk amongst these beautiful buildings and gorgeous gardens and even just look at the people. There's a guy walking past me now in the most interesting spandex leggings. So you never know when you come out in Paris what you're going to see.
Maybe he's a writer too and doing an afternoon walk.
That would be a kind way of looking at those leggings.
Ooh, a deliciously past remarkable way to spend the afternoon. That was the very beautiful lyric feature from Sunday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Now the bit you've all been waiting for.
After you. Government formation in slow motion.
Well, ain't that the truth, brother, but don't worry, we'll get you there. And on Thursday, the 33rd Dáil reconvened and Barry Lenehan caught the mood down at the Dáil for drive time.
This is Dáil Éireann's All-Ireland final day, Mary. The corridors of Leinster House much more packed and boisterous than usual. Busloads of supporters from every corner of the country. People trying to secure a golden ticket, that being a pass into the Dáil Chamber to cheer on one of the 48 new TDs. Talk of carvery dinners and maybe even a drink before the clock had even struck noon. And promises too that Kerry will hush Dublin and no, neither Peter Keane nor David Clifford are on Kildare Street. Instead, the promises, the noise, the colour came from what's become the annual Healy Ray party on Kildare Street on the opening day of Dáil Éireann.
We want to thank each and every one of you from the bottoms of our hearts for the canvassing. We'll never be found wanting, and what we don't do for you, nobody else.
Yeah! Oh, I can't get out, Brad!
He'll be there for me.
Kerry Independent TDs Michael and Danny Healy Ray. But jigs and reels aside, there was still the business of government formation. And to be honest, you might have detected a certain sense of lethargy across the airwaves this week, as we're really only in the halfpenny place when it comes to coalition manoeuvrings. But let's start on Monday.
Niamh Lyons, is this, to borrow the, or to adapt that famous phrase of the late Seamus Mallon, is this a case of grand coalition for slow learners? Is this what's kind of, you know, they saw headlines over the weekend and the two big parties have taken fright?
Possibly, but I'm surprised the more I talk to people, particularly in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, the more I think we're farther away from that than anything else, because there's just such internal opposition to the two old rivals getting together. Both of them think that only one party will survive if that happens. And I think the mood going into this Fine Gael meeting, from what I'm picking up, there's a bit of unease and there's a bit of anger. There's a sort of a big question mark about why it was Fine Gael suffered more from a confidence supply than Fianna Fáil, who are providing that deal. And there's also a sense that there's a couple of seats that they left out there on the pitch. I'm definitely not picking up anything in relation to Leo Varadkar's leadership directly. But what some people are questioning is, could someone come after him for a big job from Europe? Is he going to stay put in opposition? And it's a big job now for Leo Varadkar to rebuild the party. Is he the man for the chicken and chips circuit?
Is he indeed? And specifically, would Leo go here?
In other words, you're wondering whether he relishes the thought of heading down to, I don't know, Temple Glantine in Patrick O'Donovan's constituency.
He'd be very welcome.
On a windy night in February to
meet the
Trent. We'll have a fine big crowd for him, Sean, if he does, because we're one of the constituencies that produced the strongest Fine Gael vote in the country.
Except you dropped a seat.
We did, and in fairness, we dropped seats all over the country and we went them back.
Want them back for good. Well, Fine Gael met for 6 hours on Monday and Leo said he is relishing opposition and the chicken and chip circuit. And it seems to be a case of opposition, absolutely, until it's not. Here's the Irish Times' Fiacc Kelly reading the room on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
A lot of senior members of the government then pivoted the mood of the meeting back towards, OK, we want to go into opposition, but we should keep open government in the national interest. One of those was Charlie Flanagan, who also apologised for the controversy over the RIC commemoration, and tarnished to Simon Coveney. And I think his intervention, according to one of those presents, it was interesting because it was timed about halfway or three quarters way through the meeting. It's almost like he wanted to steer the meeting in a certain way. But I think also interesting is someone who did not speak on the idea of coalition, and that is the Minister of Finance, Pascal Donoghue. He gave a presentation at the outset of the meeting on the election performance, the findings of the Ipsos MRBI RTE Irish Times exit poll, but didn't say anything on coalition formulation. And there is a bit of speculation in the party that perhaps he is not that keen on this idea of a grand coalition. So people were watching to see if he said anything, and he didn't.
On Wednesday, Green Party leader Eamon Ryan spoke with Sean O'Rourke.
Eamon Ryan, you're meeting Sinn Féin later, and I would expect that they will say to you in private what they've already said to you in public about certainly dealing with the other big parties aside from themselves. Don't do it.
Can I just, and we said this, I think I did about 50 interviews during the election campaign. In every single interview, I repeated this point, which I'm going to repeat again now. To make the leap we need to make in climate, which is beyond compare in scale of change, to the better, it will not work if we do it as a divisive thing, where we're saying we're ruling out all that section of society. It's everyone's going to be involved in this. It's going to improve everyone's quality of life, in my mind, if we get it right. So that then leads you towards a form of politics where if you say, well, sorry, we refuse to recognise your mandate, in any party, be that Sinn Féin or Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil or the Independents or whoever, if we were to approach this and saying, sorry, the people who voted for you, the people that you sent as representative, we're not going to talk to, well, then how are we going to get those people to buy into the change we need? I don't believe that's the way it works. The way, if we create climate as a divisive issue between left and right or between rural and urban or between young and old, it will not work. We have to pull people together, and that's what we seek to do.
But Sean's not quite buying it.
It sounds like you almost have no leverage at all then.
We'll see in the next few weeks.
Are you just desperate that you have to be in government?
No,
I mean,
no. If there isn't...
I recall, John, I used to joke, well, not so much joke with him, but I used to remind him regularly, John Gormley, your previous leader, saying, I cannot bear the thought of another period in opposition.
No, I don't have that feeling at all. We will sit down and talk to parties and we will present what we presented in a manifesto. If we can deliver some of that in government, then I don't think we should be afraid of that. It is difficult, but it is a responsibility you have. The people who voted for us, I think, by and large, want you
right,
to try and do
can
what
you envisage circumstances, Eamon Ryan, as leader of the Green Party, in which you would just walk away from the table and say, no, we're not getting enough?
Absolutely. If they can't address the sort of scale of climate change and biodiversity crisis measures we need, clearly we would have to walk away straight away.
Eamon Ryan with Sean on Wednesday, but back to the Dáil on Thursday. Four party leaders were nominated as Taoiseach, with Mary Lou MacDonald coming closest with 45 votes, but as everyone always knew, still not enough. On Thursday night, late debates, Katie Hannan put Micheál Martin's position thus to Colette Brown.
But when he looks at his options, Sinn Féin in government with him, Sinn Féin sitting over there in the opposition benches growing in strength, Fine Gael in government with him are sitting over there in the opposition benches, regrouping and finding themselves again. It is the absolute example of a rock and a hard place.
It's completely. And, you know, he has only himself to blame in one respect because of the red lines that he painted in advance of the election. He's at real crossroads now because any option represents a real danger. So for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to go into government together, it's basically the end of civil war politics. So it'd be an admission from both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael that actually there's no ideological difference with them. They can easily do business with each other, and maybe the people will see that there isn't that much of a difference between them after all. If he leaves Sinn Féin on the opposition benches, Sinn Féin's strength will grow and grow and grow because they'll be the country's main opposition opposition, and they do opposition really quite well, as we've seen over the last number of years.
Well, speaking of opposing sides, on yesterday's Morning Ireland, Sandra Hurley clipped these fractious exchanges between Micheál Martin and Mary Lou MacDonald.
We do not believe that Sinn Féin operates to the same democratic standards held by every other party in this House. Deputy MacDonald has confirmed that she does not accept any of our criticism, that's her entitlement, of her party's practices and standards. We simply do not agree. And this is not simply about the past. The past is important, and Sinn Féin's efforts to legitimise a murderous sectarian campaign keeps alive a narrative which is used by dissidents to legitimise their campaigns today. But this is more fundamentally about today.
This elicited an angry response from Mary Lou MacDonald.
Change also means that the old order must pass. And you see, that's really what the problem is here. Because, of course, government formation is about numbers. We can add. Of course, government formation is about policy coherence. No one's arguing to the contrary. But government formation is also about power and who wields it. And the reality is that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have run the show for almost a century, and by Christ, they're not minded to let go.
Oh, that doesn't bode well. So where to now? A coalition of the left still cannot be definitively ruled out. Might Sinn Féin cobble together enough to make something work? And now it seems Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are going to have a little chat next week. Do I feel a bit of In the National Interest coming on? Well, on Thursday, Paul Cunningham on Morning Ireland squeezed the whole shebang into one pithy little minute.
If you can imagine, there's a triple dynamic going on here. Within a party, you've got people deciding what is the most important policy that we have within our manifesto, what are we going to do? There's also inter-party dynamic, because the two parties are looking at each other, well, if they're doing this, are we going to do that? And you've got a third dynamic, which is communicating to the public about what their priorities are and how they're going to move. And to a certain extent, when you look at an election campaign from a media perspective, before the election, it's all about how they define themselves, what makes us different to someone else, why we're better from someone else. And then post-election is about, well, you're all the same, so you've got so much in common, why don't you get together? So teasing those things out, stretching it out between moving away from the personality into policy, into a programme for government does take time. And I think any observer would have said that you were never going to get anywhere before St. Patrick's Day. It more than likely was going to be after that and possibly into April. So from a public perspective, there's clearly a desire for people to act on those big issues which they have huge concerns about. And yet at the same time, I think we have to be fair to the politicians to give them some time to be able to move forward.
So, time it is then. Well, we are almost at a finish here on Playback. Thank you for listening. And call me a cliche, but I think we're going to finish with this.